We took it all. We brought them to our land. An endless night. Ember hot and icy cold. The rage of the earth. We made this curse. Carved it in the blood on our backs. We did not see. We could not, but she did. And in the end...
What will I become?
Senua Saga. Hellblade 2.
Play it now with Game Pass.
Welcome to Techno Roll, a special Letter Roll maxi series discussing Michelangelo Matos's book, The Underground is Massive: How Electronic Dance Music Conquered America, hosted by Nate Wilcox and Ryan Harkness. Letter Roll is the insanely ambitious musical history podcast. We've covered the early history of rock and roll, country music in the 20th century, the rise of hip-hop, disco, and electronic dance music, and now heavy metal. Stay tuned for our histories of Broadway, opera, punk rock, jazz, blues, and gospel. Follow the Let It Roll podcast on Twitter, at Let It Rollcast, and check out our website at letitrollpodcast.com. Let It Roll is a Pantheon podcast, and you can listen to more great podcasts at www.pantheonpodcasts.com. Today, Nate and Ryan discuss Disco Donnie, the DEA, and the rave bust that brought the first era of rave to an end. Email us at letitrollpodcast@gmail.com. Pop in those earbuds and enjoy.
It's time to Let It Roll, or shall I say Techno Roll. I'm your host, Nate Wilcox, joined once again by Ryan Harkness to continue our discussion of Michelangelo Matos's The Underground is Massive, How Electronic Dance Music Conquered America. And last week, we talked about the feel-good show of the book so far, the Detroit Electronic Musical Festival from early in 2000. And now it's time to talk about a great big bummer. We're talking about the Future Fat Hong Kong Phooey show in New Orleans, Louisiana, August 26, 2000, and it wasn't the promoters or musicians that made this a great big bummer.
Yeah, the DEA comes in real heavy, and they use the crack house laws for the first time to try and go after a promoter. And this is actually a story that I've got a personal connection to, because Disco Donnie is the one that whose face is attached to this whole story. But his partner, DJ Strife in the Freebase Society, he is actually my co-promoter's cousin from the United States. So we brought him up for a rave in 2001, and he told us all about all the crazy stuff that was going on there with Disco Donnie and everything else like that. It was pretty intense hearing it basically second, like so close to us.
Yeah. I mean, this is where stuff got serious, and it was a bad scene. And Disco Donnie is a guy named Donnie Estopinal, James Donnie Estopinal, called Disco Donnie after his dad, who was also a DJ and apparently not a great dad.
It's hard to say. The book definitely paints him as a terrible absent father. Other interviews I've read with Disco Donnie seem to imply that he spent a lot of time in the disco with his dad. So I'm not sure, you know, with Disco Donnie, there's a lot of presentation and there's a lot of character, and you never really know where, you know, Disco Donnie ends and the real James begins, kind of thing.
Yeah. That's very true. And there's a quote, you know, I made a mental note to try to pay attention to the quotes Matos puts at the beginning of these chapters. And this week's quote is, it's Disco Donnie asking a security guard, what does PLUR stand for? And the R. So I guess the security guard got the PL and U. And the R goes rehab, which is pretty good. PLUR,
yeah,
of course,
this is a quote from Rise, the story of Disco Donnie, which is a documentary that you can find if you look hard enough on the internet. It's
Amazon.
Well, it's on Amazon in America. Up here in Canada, I had to pay some fly-by-night website like $3, and we'll see whether or not, you know, my credit card gets used to buy like a couple thousand dollars worth of jade in China or something like that. So the things I do for this podcast.
I know. I need to get you to help me track down the KLF documentary that's only available on Amazon in the UK.
I have the whole thing.
Well, we'll solve that. But anyway, Plur, of course, stands for peace, love, unity, and respect, and was a big motto of ravers in the 90s. But the guard thought it stood for rehab, which is a reasonable enough supposition.
Yeah, it's a pretty good joke. It's a pretty good joke. You know, the documentary reminded me of a bunch of, the documentary doesn't delve into Disco Donnie's legal problems with the crack house law. It implies that it does. And the documentary came out in 2004, a couple of years after everything was resolved. But this is one of those creative products where, you know, it was clearly filmed in like a couple of nights. They got their footage and then they just did what they could with it. And they tacked Disco Donnie as a starring feature on him after he became a bit of a national celebrity due to this whole crack house law thing. But it has nothing really to do with any of that. But there was a lot of like fond memories. It's the perfect movie if you weren't there to see what it was like, to see what the people were dressed like, to see what the vibe was and how everybody was acting. And one of the things that it reminded me of is the security that you hire for these raves, they're always... You always want to get these kind of lighthearted joker guys who are, you know, might not understand what's going on, but they think it's pretty all right. And that security guard is exactly like that.
Definitely. And the movie is delightful. It really, they feature a number of ravers, young kids that are fans. And I think it gives you a feel for what people were into, the positive side of the scene, and the music in it is really good. I think Josh Wink did the soundtrack for it. But yeah, this chapter focuses mostly on the legal problems. But once again, as he's wont to do, Matos weaves in quite a bit of the national story and what's going on. And he uses this episode to kind of talk about the greater South, not just New Orleans, but what's going on and the overall thing. And as he is wont to do, he brings back one of these recurring characters. And this time it's Tommy Sunshine, who we talked about in the further chapter. We talked about him in the Storm Rave chapter. We talked about him in the Grave chapter. So
Tommy, he's been around.
He's definitely been around. And in the mid 90s, he stumbled across Atlanta, which, you know, I guess he hadn't heard about a mid-sized or large city in the American Southeast. But he liked it. He moved there from around 95 to 99. He went to Interstellar Overdrive in Lexington, Kentucky in August of 94 first, after we saw him at Further, where I believe he confronted a policeman completely out of his gourd and holding a bunch of drugs and managed to talk the guy off. And that was when he decided, I need to get away from show promotion. But he goes to Interstellar Overdrive in Lexington, sees a 23-year-old woman flatline off of a heroin overdose. She actually survived, but that freaked him out. So he keeps moving. He moves to Atlanta, likes it, starts getting DJ gigs, bluffs his way into managing a record store called Wish, which was owned by Scott Richmond, who also owned New York Satellite Records. And by 1999, he's managing 12 DJ employees there at the record store. And I think the point of this anecdote was really to tell people how big record stores were in the 90s, and that dance music tended to be specialty shops because they still had vinyl, where everybody else had CDs almost exclusively by that point.
And yeah, at this point in time, like basically any CD, any city that you went to would have several specialty dance vinyl stores. Like Ottawa, where I'm from, is not a big city at all. You know, it's a million people if you cheat and count all of the suburbs that are kind of like an hour away. And we had three or four vinyl, like underground dance vinyl stores in it around 1998. So it just goes to show you, like, you know, the business was booming at this time.
Yeah, and it was still very vinyl. The CD players that you could mix with hadn't really been perfected yet. So DJs really needed to play on turntables with vinyl records, which meant that the records were made on vinyl because the DJs were the key audience. And a lot of them were really small print runs. And, you know, Tommy Sunshine talks about how every Sunday they would do their orders and the New York office would play him samples of tracks over speakerphone. And he'd have to decide, do I need to order more of this or not? But let's go ahead and hear our first song. This is Left Field's Song of Life from 1992. We'll be right back. And that was Song of Life from Left Field. 1992, Ryan, we're in 2000. Why'd you pick this one? What's going on here?
Well, you know, this episode, I decided to pick a bunch of songs off of the Disco Donnie documentary. And the movie starts with Song of Life, and it might be a 1992 track. This is the 12-inch mix, which is personally my favorite other than the Cut for Life remix. But this track, Song of Life, is one of those rave tracks that, like, there's 30 different versions of it leading up to 1997 when Left Field put out Leftism, was the album. And then Song of Life, the album version, becomes the one that everybody knows. But before that, it was just a killer on vinyl. And there were so many different versions of it out there that it kept its importance over those 10 years, as you can tell, considering the fact that the movie the documentary in 2004 opens up with Song of Life. So it's one of those timeless rave anthems.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think it gives you a feel for the way people were not just dancing to the new releases, they were dancing to what made them dance. And so DJs would keep a lot of oldie but goodies in their boxes and play them at sets. And the last thing you mentioned about music retail at this point in time is that 1999 was the zenith of the U.S. record industry. It sold $16.4 billion in CDs alone. And the vinyl sales were, you know, a minor subset of that, but still very healthy numbers and could support, like you said, lots of stores. And then the South overall, you had kind of, you know, it's a big sprawled out area. And so it rave took hold more sporadically in the spread out South than it did further north. And you had areas like Lexington, Louisville, and St. Louis that were basically connected to the Midwest scene. If you've ever been in those cities, you know that they're just a hop, skip, and a jump away from Chicago and very much in touch with the Midwest. So they were kind of integrated into that. Florida, as we've talked about, had its own self-contained circuit. Florida is very much the 58th state or whatever out in its own world. But you also had like Charlotte, North Carolina, which had a pretty good thriving scene. You had Dallas, Nashville, and Atlanta. You know, and Charlotte, you could say 500 people out for a party. Nashville and Atlanta, you get several thousand people out for parties. But for size and spectacle, New Orleans exerted Southern Rave's most magnetic pull. And a lot of the credit goes to James Estepinal Jr., a.k.a. Disco Donnie.
Yeah, his Zulu parties in New Orleans were legendary. I mean, and talk about like a perfect launching pad for your rave promotion is having Mardi Gras. And Zulu was the big Mardi Gras weekend rave that would there'd be multiple pre-parties and after parties through it, but the big Zulu event was the centerpiece of it, and that would clear like 10,000 people. It would be a big massive thing every year.
Yeah, and he put on parties like the psychedelic Pimp Daddy Land on May 24th, 1997, Attack of the 50-Foot Raver Zombies October 30th, 1999. So he definitely had a certain flair and branding, obviously the name of this week's party, the Future Fat Hong Kong Fooey Party. And they tended to be held at the State Palace Theater in downtown New Orleans. He had a good partnership with the owners there. And by 2000, he was selling tickets in 20 states, partnering with Ticketmaster. He's co-promoting other shows in Dallas, Atlanta, Miami. And don't take it from me. Take it from Tommy Sunshine that we were talking about earlier. As Mato says, Tommy Sunshine, who's been arrested at Grave, gone berserk at the final storm rave, and gotten so fried at Further that he passed out but kept dancing, said Donnie threw the craziest parties ever in America, no question. So quite a feat.
Yeah, he's definitely got a well-deserved reputation for kind of capturing the North American rave ethos, because this is, you know, it's important. We spend so much time talking about UK rave and European rave, and North American rave often doesn't get its props for being this whole cultural touchstone. And these events in New Orleans really solidified, you know, that this is an event for outsiders and weirdos to congregate and express themselves in a beautiful way. These events were really kind of key ones, and you can't really say enough about all of Disco Donnie's parties. Maybe the only thing that I'd say that he did wrong was when he was throwing parties in New Orleans, the promotion company that they decided to call it was Free Bass Society, you know, free bass, and the bass was two yeah. S's, like bass instead of, you know, free bass and crack, because that's witty. And this is a weird trend. Rave promoters often give their rave company names crazy drug reference double meanings, and it's just not a good idea, because when the DEA is looking for somebody to make an example of, they're going to come after the Free Bass Society.
Yeah, it's definitely and there was a whole ethos in the 90s of sort of transgressive quote-unquote type things, and so some of the names for his events are a little bit dubious taste. And in the movie, he's walking around with the Confederate flag ball cap on, and it's part of a costume. He's playing a character, and they even show him talking to a black guy he bumps into and trying to make it clear to the guy, hey, I hope this isn't offending you, it's just a joke or whatever. But when you need to make that explanation, you might want to just reconsider your joke. Yeah.
Well, you know, he was big into the idea of, like, you know, dressing like a pimp or dressing like this. You know, it was it was the time of kind of edgy anti-establishment stuff. And like, he had a series of club nights called Tight, and they used to have pictures of sex dolls on the cover of it and stuff. So this is just the kind of thing that was like a standard late 90s kind of edgy thing. And his events were kind of full of those. And some of the ideas were great, and some of the ideas were terrible. But, you know, it takes a little bit of insanity and crazy ideas in order to kind of keep people interested.
Yeah, and we talked about Woodstock 99 last time, and that's kind of what this culture sort of morphed into. It went from this sort of rebellious outsider thing into this sort of frat boy yuckiness. But let's get back to Disco Donnie. He moved home to Atlanta. He went to LSU in Baton Rouge for college. It doesn't say if he graduated or not, but he majored in accounting.
He graduated. He's a smart guy.
So he's an accountant, and he moves home in 1994. His father, Disco Jim, had abandoned the family, just moved away one weekend, and then the mother finally tracked him down like a year later, and he had become Disco Jim and become this DJ. And like you said, Donnie talks in the movie about, you know, sleeping on the floor at the disco and stuff. So he was definitely involved in his father's career, but and he was a fraternity president at LSU, and frequently would like book acts like REM and Love Tractor. And this was this Athens, Georgia alternative rock scene that was big in the 80s. And he was doing that. Then he gets his first taste of rave culture at Ruby Fruit Jungle in New Orleans at Cafe Istanbul. And he was like blown away by the mix of people. It was like, it was drag queens, supermodels, hookers, frat guys, everybody. But it was just about 100 people. And he couldn't believe, you know, so few people were involved in what he thought was just such an incredible scene. So he volunteers to help the promoters with the next show. The next time, he brings in such a big crowd, dramatically larger, you know, larger by like a multiple of five, that he asks for 50% next time and gets it. And so he becomes Disco Donnie, this legendary promoter.
And it's crazy how he started out basically as a flyer guy, and just, you know, in the beginning when he was flying, he was one of those flyer guys. It's not like, you know, oh, you're getting X number of dollars an hour to stand outside of this club and do it. He was just hunting down the promoters, asking for stacks of flyers, and just going out and doing it because he was a true believer. And that slowly morphed into him getting so good at it that he became the promotional flyer guy that everybody was kind of looking for. And let me tell you, like, you can be the idea guy, you can be the head promoter, but you ain't shit without a solid flyer network distribution guy. And that's where Disco Donnie came in, and where he kind of cut his teeth as and grew into becoming the main kind of New Orleans promoter.
Yeah, pre-internet in the 90s, we called this stuff guerrilla marketing or street teams. And that's definitely, Donnie was a one-man street team. But let's hear our next song. This is Trendsetters, Roaches, Bugs in Slacker's Basement Remix from 2000. was the Bugs in Slacker's Basement remix of Roaches by Trancesetters from 2000. Why'd we pick this one?
I just wanted to show people kind of where trance was sitting around the year 2000, where, you know, the best stuff was straddling kind of between the more commercial trance sound and the progressive elements that kind of allowed for a more a trancey vibe to emerge. And Slacker is one of those artists that, you know, didn't put out terrible 13-minute bore fests, but managed to combine the best of both progressive and, you know, more epic uplifting trance into one package.
And what a package it was. And this was the kind of stuff people were dancing to in this period. Trance was having a big moment. And like you said, Progressive House was having a big moment at that time too. And so, but back to Disco Donnie. By, let's see, 1995, he drew 1,500 people to his first Mardi Gras event at the State Palace Theater. He hired DJs Mystic Bill and Terry Mullen from Chicago. And basically, he didn't know much about the scene or who was who or what was what, but he would read the massive, and he would get hands on flyers from New York, Atlanta, and DC, and he would just look for the headliners and track them down and try to book them for his shows. So,
and this is a standard thing that was going on a lot around a lot of different places. Like, promoters would love to get flyers from all the different areas. You go to a record shop and they'd have walls full of all these flyers for everything. You know, we always talk about the Midwest scene and how there's like a 10-hour drive that's acceptable to do on the highway one way or another from your city. You get all the flyers from all those areas. You package them all up, and basically promoters from different cities would look at these things to try to figure out who were the big DJs they should be bringing in. It was, everybody was misfits. Everybody was just like one man islands trying to figure out what the hell was going on everywhere else.
And Donnie was one of the ones who was really good at it, but he also went the extra mile. He did things like he set up a voicemail line and he would actually answer every call, and especially zeroed in on the complaints and tried to fix things that people had problems with. But, you know, he aimed for the unique at his parties. He once brought in a choir to sing Amazing Grace at 3 a.m. at a party. He would do things like book the Sugar Hill Gang, you know, the legendary first hip hop artist to make a record. He had a dance contest with Rerun from What's Happening, the 70s sitcom. So, you know, he's definitely capturing the zeitgeist there. And New Orleans is just a perfect party town. So, like, by 1997, he's drawing 2,500 people a day to his multi-day Mardi Gras extravaganza. You know, in 1996, he had 2,000 people. By 1999, he's got 5,000 people. He had to expand to multiple buildings adjacent to the State Palace Theater. He built a deck on the roof up there. They kind of had their own, you know, a big pool to fish in, because there's no dominant scene within a 10-hour drive of New Orleans. So, you know, had a big area to themselves. He opens a record shop right next to the Palace Theater, kept that open all night during the raves. He even put it between the main arena, the main theater, and the jungle room. So if you wanted to go to the second room and hear some jungle, you'd have to go to the record store. And so they would have nights on show nights where they would do as much as sales as they would do in a normal week. So definitely a good business model. They also featured a lot of mixtape makers, mixtapes made by local DJs like Strife, who's Daniel Milstein, who specialized in UK style hard house. He also had Trent Cantarelli, who specialized in progressive house, but he was also selling mixtapes from New Yorkers like Micro and Frankie Bones. And, you know, people like DJ Monk of Tampa, from who's also in Rabbit of the Moon, which was one of the big acts at this time. He talked about how distinctively fun the New York or the New Orleans vibe was. He contrasted it with like the New York scene, where clubs like Limelight, you'd have all these club kids bombed out on their minds on ketamine, and you play into a bunch of zombies who are just standing there. Maybe after the show, they tell you how great it was, but it's a lot different in New Orleans, where they're visibly, obviously having a great time.
Yeah, different cities have different levels of energy, and unfortunately, it usually corresponds to where the scene is in its kind of life cycle and what drugs are currently prevalent in the scene. And as we talked about in a couple of the other episodes, sometimes you just have a bad scene that's gotten into meth, and it's like 3 years in, and everybody's burnt out, and it's just bad. But New Orleans was still happening, and still a lot of fun, and everybody was really giving it their all.
Yeah, and then Matas once again cleverly weaves in the Winter Music Conference, which had been going on in Miami. I think we talked about it at the Circuit House episode we did, and maybe a couple others. But Donnie actually meets Tommy Sunshine at one of these, the Miami Winter Conference in 1999. He was hosting a party featuring DJ Laurent Garnier. Is that how to say it?
Yeah, pretty much.
Okay, you're just gonna let me hang.
I mean, like French people say it differently. English people massacre it, but everyone's okay with it. It's cool. Like, don't worry about it.
Yeah. All right. So, as long as I'm forgiven, it'll be all right. But the attendance of the Winter Music Conference had tripled between 1995 and 1999. There was a flood of music industry money from the big electronica push of 96, 97, 98 that we've been talking about. By 1999, there were parties for virtually every style of dance music every night. It was easy to find good MDMA, but people were noticing that the scene had lost its idealistic communalism and was becoming big business. Jonas Sharp of Spacetime Continuum is kind of the one that Matos chooses for the telling anecdote. He was set to play at 1 a.m. at the Astral Works WMC party in 1999. He was supposed to go on before, but he was on the bill with Fatboy Slim and Todd Terry, but he was booked for the 1 a.m. slot. But the other act's managers were giving him trouble and trying to push him back and hork his start time. So he was kind of like, you know, screw this. This is not how it used to be. This is not the scene. And it is, you know, it's a very different thing. It's like you've got celebrities like Iggy Pop, who happens to live in Miami, just dropping into parties and stuff. And so it's changing. And one thing that this book has really kind of gotten across to me is that, yeah, it took a long time for electronic dance music to take over and become pop music in America. But that meant that there was this underground scene and there were these virtues and this communalism and this plur vibe that I don't think you had as much in Europe or England, where it was this overwhelmingly popular scene.
Yeah, definitely. I know from people who have gone to the Winter Music Conference that it's a bit of a culture shock, because you get there and all of a sudden you're dealing with exclusive door policies and bottle fees and all sorts of crazy stuff where you're not allowed like through the door without like, you know, paying $100 or something like that. It's just very different and very business oriented. And this is one of the big complaints I have just about the fact that we're talking about how electronic music made it in America. And it's really just from one metric of, you know, music sales. All of a sudden, okay, finally the music industry is able to make money off the scene. But the underground was always there. The underground was, you know, hot and cold in different areas of the country, but it was always surviving and going. And yeah, you go to a Winter Music Conference and it's kind of an embodiment of a bunch of the stuff that you didn't want to happen. So there's a weird love-hate thing that a lot of people have with the WMC.
Yeah, and we'll talk a little bit about the downfall of the underground scene in America and why it does ultimately have to go big as we get later in this episode. But first, more stuff from the Winter Music Conference. Matos cleverly weaves in Moby here, and we've talked about Moby throughout.
He should have just had his own chapter. I'm tired of going back to Moby for a paragraph every, like, I know it doesn't fit with his event thing, but just put Moby in one place.
I don't know. I kind of like the recurring Moby, because it lets you catch up with where the scene is at the time. And let's take a sponsor break. When we come back, we'll hear about Moby's biggest stunt yet.
We took it all. We brought them to our land. An endless night. Ember hot and icy cold. The rage of the earth. We made this curse. Carved it in the blood on our backs. We did not see. We could not, but she did. And in the end,
what will I become?
Senua Saga. Hellblade 2.
Play it now with Game Pass.
And maybe stunt's the wrong word. This would be Moby's biggest caper yet, or biggest album yet. In fact, it was the biggest album in the history of electronic dance music, at least the first generations of it. He puts out Play, in 99, I want to say, and it followed up his Animal Rights album, where he had tried to play, he did play rock music. I mean, it wasn't like he was some kind of total horrible amateur. It's just not what people wanted to hear from Moby. But he puts
Animal,
out.
Animal Rights had dance music, it had rock music, and it had a couple of tracks that would have fit on Play as well. So there was kind of the remnants of what he was, what he used to do, something he tried to do and failed, and then what he eventually would like succeed astronomically in.
Yeah, and so for Play, like we mentioned last time, he had found all these samples of old Library of Congress recordings of African American performers, but it was so successful by the Winter Music Conference of 2000. He's the big draw. He plays the Crowbar on March 23. Play won the Village Voice Critics Poll for Best Album. And back in the day, the Village Voice was the New York alternative weekly. It had Robert Christgau as its main critic, but it had tons of other great music writers, Greg Tate, Nelson George, all kinds of people wrote for the Village Voice. And their critics poll was really closely watched, even though the Village Voice was, you know, nominally only distributed in New York City. Writers all around the country would cover, you know, would follow and take their lead from the Village Voice. So Play winning the critics poll for best album was a big deal. But even bigger was they got the track Porcelain featured on the Beach soundtrack, which was a Leonardo DiCaprio movie that came out around that time. And very soon, because his management worked Hollywood so hard, like in 1996, they had a party for, quote, every music supervisor in Hollywood at the Slam Dance Film Festival in Utah. And they really worked those connections. And then in August 1999, ABC picks up Body Rock off the Play album for a Dharma and Greg promo. And soon, over the next year and a half, more than 200 promos, ads, soundtracks, and other placements for Play are made. By April 2000, all 18 tracks have been licensed by somebody for something in the media. Then he did a version of Southside with Gwen Stefani of No Doubt singing vocals that pushed it even further over the top. It spent 14 months in the Billboard Top 100. That's not quite Dark Side of the Moon longevity, but it's pretty good. Sold over 10 million copies worldwide. Definitely the biggest album to ever emerge from the rave scene. So this is kind of Moby's big moment.
Yeah, I got an issue with this. Is the biggest album to emerge from the rave scene? Maybe because it doesn't really emerge from the rave scene. Like I get Moby came from the rave scene, but like it's kind of like if you have a rave artist who then makes like a movie score or a movie soundtrack or an ambient album, is it really still a rave album? You know what I mean? It's it's kind of like how last week where we were talking about Prodigy having like the biggest one of the biggest rave albums, but it was kind of remarked upon that, you know, as soon as Fat of the Land came out, it was put into that alternative box. So it rave, there was no rising tide that raised all boats here. These albums were taken completely out of any kind of rave context and just moved to where they needed to be more commercially successful.
Yeah, and the fact that Moby became so commercially successful based on his placement in ads and movies and TV shows, like Simon Reynolds talked about this and we discussed it in the last series, that had the kind of effect of making electronic dance music ubiquitous but never triumphant. It's not like it was the dominant musical form, but it was still everywhere, and corporate America really liked it. And that kind of added to kind of some of the weirdness of this period and what we'll see in the weirdness of the coming decade. And then he talks about, you know, the New York City club scene and how the crackdown started there, essentially. Limelight, infamous for the murders and the club kids, was shut down in 1997, but instead of easing up after that, the Rudy Giuliani administration in New York just cracked down even harder. And so by the turn of the millennium, ravers who want to go to clubs in New York City are having to put up with, like, you know, security guards putting their hands in their underwear, opening their mouth and being inspected, really degrading, humiliating stuff. Meanwhile, you know, the burnout is seeping into dance music culture all over the country. Like Minneapolis at a Twin Cities party, ravers are eating drugs off the floor. Meth is taking over. Ecstasy is not working for people. So this, like you said earlier, this life cycle of these dance and drug scenes, you know, it's got an ugly end. It talks about some of the West Coast people. The way they dealt with it was that a bunch of ravers from Seattle and San Francisco flew to Hawaii for a camp out rave on New Year, New Year's of the Millennium, and Sunshine Jones and Moonbeam of the Dub Tribe sound system led a crew out there. So, you know, things are tough all over, and we're about to talk about what, you know, the ton of bricks that lands on Disco Donna in New Orleans, but the scene is kind of falling apart everywhere else in the country at the same time.
Yeah, I mean, we talk about turnover, and from my experience, it's about 2 to 3 years for a scene or a group of people in a scene to kind of come in, have their honeymoon, and then the ugly divorce. And some people try to hold on and stay in for way too long. They at least need to take a break. And then hopefully you have a whole new group of people who are coming in, who are able to pick it up and carry it and go through that whole same boom and bust thing. But yeah, it makes sense that if things were bopping in 1996, by 1999, you're seeing like all of the corpses and everything else, all the fallout from those 3 or 4 years of hard partying.
Yeah, there's always a price to pay. And in Disco Donnie's case, it was in the form of police and drug enforcement agency surveillance. And so one day in 1999, he wakes up and three agents are banging on his front door saying, who are the drug dealers? You know, and they offer to pay him to be an informer. They're like, how much do you make a year? We'll double it if you'll rat people out. But he's, you know, he's just a music promoter. He's not, he knows that people are buying and selling drugs at his shows, but that's not his business. So he's not into it, doesn't know, but he gets really paranoid. And then like he goes to the Netherlands just for a vacation with his mom. And, you know, he's on a train and suddenly he's getting searched on the train. He's the only person on the train getting searched and they're going through everything and his stuff. Then at airport security, they take him in the side room and, you know, he gets the impression they think he's in Holland to buy drugs with my mom, you know, like just really infuriating and maddening. And then by May 2000, the NOLA DEA office, New Orleans, Louisiana DEA office, is convinced that Donnie's a front man for the Burnett brothers who own the State Palace Theater. They think they're the big drug dealers behind the whole thing. They just can't seem to fathom that you can just make money promoting dances and that is a business in itself. And this is where I think a scene really has to become ubiquitous if it's going to survive. Like in the 60s in England, the Rolling Stones were being persecuted. You know, they were being busted over and over again. Some of the busts were legit because they had drugs. Other times they would have cops planting stuff on them. They kind of hounded Brian Jones to his death. But Keith Richards said that once they did the Hyde Park concert in London, free concert, downtown London, 500,000 people show up. At that point, the police gave up because, hey, these guys are stars. This is mainstream. We're not going to beat this tide. And that's kind of what Rave had not managed to do. And so the backlash comes because there have been so many news reports about ODs and drug busts that.
Yeah, the big thing was there was 400 hospitalizations due to drug overdoses directly tied to the Free Base Society party. So it's one of those things where you're like, you really want to hate the DEA and hate the government for doing what they were doing, but they were, it wasn't even a response to an imaginary moral panic. There was a quite the spate of drug overdoses. There was a drug death that went on in like a 17-year-old girl died of ecstasy overdose and overhydration. So that's what kicked the whole thing off, the whole investigation. And the DEA's big mistake is they treated it like it was some kind of cartel thing, like there was one kingpin behind the whole thing, where if they had anybody with any experience in the scene, they would know that it's a bunch of little boutique dealers who are all like, basically there might be a couple of suppliers somewhere on the fringes, but it's definitely not the people who are the faces of the party promoting the party doing it, or the venue owners who are in one place that can't disappear that are doing it. It's not like that. And it was the same thing that the DEA did when they went after all the drug dealing in the limelight, is they refused to believe that it was a network of dealers that were just low-level people, and they kept on trying to tie it back to Peter Gation, who was the owner of the bar. And that's why it never led anywhere, because they would let all of the low-level drug dealers go in exchange for lies about who was in control of the whole thing, because they wanted to hear those lies, and they wanted to hear that it was Disco Donnie and it was the owners of the of that venue.
State Palace Theater, yeah. Let's go ahead and hear our next track. This is Josh Winks, Are You There, the Size 9 remix. Are you there? Are you there? Are you there? was the Size 9 remix of Josh Winks. Are you there? Why did we pick this one?
You know, Josh Wink was the musical coordinator for the Disco Donnie documentary, so I thought it would be good to pick one of his tracks from it. And this is one of those ones that if you listen to the track, you might not get it. But in the movie, placed in context at a party, you hear it and you're like, oh, this is trippy and cool. So just, you know, grab that 30-second snapshot that kind of sounds like Josh Wink meets Richie Hawtin and threw it in. Hopefully you guys can get a feel for it.
Cool. And before we talk about the raid, let's talk about what was scheduled for future Fat Cat Hong Kong Phooey, which actually did happen. All these people, they did actually pull the show off and get to play. But Matos calls it a representative snapshot of the U.S. rave scene at the end of summer 2000. So he's picking this party not just because there's this pivotal drug bust, but or drug raid that didn't really end up being much of a bust. But it's also because musically, it's very much sort of a this is where the scene was at the time. So let's go through the lineup. You had DJ Sandra Collins from Kinetic Records.
One of the few trance producers in North America who is getting their due.
Yep, and trance is one of the hot sounds of the moment. So that's the trance sound there. Also had DJ Rectangle, who's a hip-hop turntablist. One of these people like Qbert or Terminator X, you know, somebody who can manipulate the turntable with all the tricks of scratching and, you know, crossfading and all that kind of stuff. So a turntablist part of the scene. You had Gene Ferris, who's coming out of Chicago and basically has evolved into progressive house by this point. Matos says that progressive house paid the bills in the Chicagoland area by this point. You had Christian Smith of Sweden bringing his supple techno. And this guy played half of his time in Europe and half of the time in the States. So the scene in the States, even though it's not a mainstream pop scene, the United States has still such a big population that even a healthy underground scene is still a draw for DJs from Europe. So it's a big part of the international business. And like you say, people like Sandra Collins and Josh Wink and others are making records that are hits in Europe. So it did originate in the States, and the States is still punching its weight pretty well. Then you also had a number of drum and bass DJs like AK1200, whose real name was Dave Minner. And you also had Renegade Hardware and Bad Company, both of which are UK drum and bass acts. And Bad Company had a track called The Nine, which was later named Drum and Bass's Greatest Track Ever by K-Mag in 2008.
Debatable.
And, yeah, well, but, you know, I'm just saying that's an opinion, but it's got a certain punch because of the magazine and the credibility there. And Matos says that those kind of sets they played live were pretty hard-hitting in contrast to the kind of stuff that was getting the press accolades in most places, like Ronnie Size and his Represent album, New Forms, won the Mercury Prize winner in England. And you also had Aphrodite doing a jump-up style. This was the stuff that was getting all the big press and getting the critical accolades, but when you heard somebody like AK1200 or Renegade Hardware live, it was much more of kind of a hardcore, hard-hitting set. And then you also had DJ Monk, who's in Rabbit of the Moon, coming out of Tampa. But I guess he was playing Hong Kong Phooey as a solo artist, this DJ Monk. But then that leads them into the whole discussion of Rabbit in the Moon. I think you mentioned Rabbit in the Moon in a previous chapter as being kind of the ubiquitous, almost to the point of being tedious, headliner at rave after rave. And it's largely because, you know, it's a three-person act, DJ Monk, along with Confucius, a.k.a. David Cristofori, and then this guy Bunny, a.k.a. Steve Econ, who's a performance artist and frontman who would wear these crazy costumes. So you already had Bunny doing this act. And then they hired the OVT audiovisual team out of Chicago in 1996 and just had absolute state-of-the-art visual techniques.
This was before that kind of stuff was really usual. Like everybody was kind of running off the same terrible 240p visuals that we were downloading off some generous Dutchman's server over in the Netherlands. But these guys here were projecting things onto weird shapes. Like now it's a pretty standard thing that you have like a video mapping onto like a weird circle or sphere or triangles or stuff like that. But these guys kind of were pioneering that. So you would have all of these globes hanging from the ceiling of different shapes, and the projectors were projecting perfectly onto them and nowhere else to create this amazing visual. And then of course you have Bunny dressed like a disco ball or in a glow stick suit. He had about 6 or 7 different costumes that he rotated through. And, you know, one of the reasons why once you've seen him, you've kind of seen him, is that, you know, the 6 or 7 costumes kind of stayed the same for about a decade.
Yeah, but at the same time they had this really booming remix business going on, and you know, Matos's playlists on Spotify for this chapter, and I highly recommend always check out Michelangelo's Spotify playlist, and also be sure and look at the mixography section in the back to hear the live sets that were being played in this period. But you know, Rabbit in the Moon is doing big time stuff. Like they remixed Sarah McLachlan's Possession just on a bootleg basis, but Network, her record label, heard it and sent them the multi-track and a contract. They're like, we want you to do this right, like, you know. So, and they had a number of hits like that. So, you know, big doings and very much representative of the scene at the time. But now let's get down to it and talk about the rave. So 8 p.m. Saturday night, a dozen uniformed officers suddenly appear at the State Palace Theater. And Matos talks to one of the record store clerks who has just kind of sees these cops, says they weren't quite dressed as full-on stormtroopers, but pretty close. And he immediately thinks to himself, ha, huh, somebody's in trouble. And next thing he knows, he's being detained. So and everybody there is detained. They detained over 30 people. Everybody had to be processed to leave, which means, you know, you had to turn in your driver's license and get searched. They're dumping people's bags out on the floor, toothbrushes everywhere. Hard drives are hitting the concrete hard. Robert Brunet of the State Palace Theater has to take agents to the office where they're grabbing all his business paperwork. Donnie's warned not to show up, but he arrives at 10 o'clock anyway. And he sees a massive line down the block waiting for the show. By the time he gets in there, you know, the DEA is in there like doing this comedy routine. They're chasing nutrias around. And nutrias are these like sort of giant rats. They're like, I guess they're even bigger than beavers. I think they're the biggest rodent, but they're these impossibly big rodent, and they're chasing these things around the theater at gunpoint. And the only drugs they find is one joint on a bartender, but they're doing things like seizing the bottled water and the fortune cookies, and it's all kind of mysterious, but people can tell it's big stuff. But then suddenly they put on masks. The police put on masks and leave the building, like they don't want people to know who they are. And the party opens up anyway at 1 a.m. They managed to talk to all the DJs, and everybody managed to play, even though they did shortened sets. But like, first thing that happens is that Donnie sees a girl having a seizure from the strobe lights. So he's like, really? You know, like, it's just kind of a bummer. But still, nonetheless, 3,000 to 5,000 people showed up and played.
And everybody had a wonderful time. And you got to give it to Donnie for having the balls of steel to actually just say that the party is going to go on anyways. Don't worry about it. Everybody stay in line. We'll open this thing up soon. And he's hanging out. Like, they tell him not to come, but he comes anyways, because he's always had this kind of naive idea that since he's quote unquote innocent, he has nothing to worry about. But he sits in this restaurant across the street from the venue, kind of just waiting for everything to die down. And a bunch of DEA agents that are looking for him come into the restaurant and sit down, and they're talking while he's sitting behind them about looking for him. And he's just quietly sitting in the background waiting for them to get up and go. So it's a funny story about how he just kind of keeps his cool. He's across just watching the cops trying to bust him in this event, just waiting for it to end so he could open the party up and keep raving.
Yep. And this is the point where Matos, and we kind of covered some of this already in the show, but Matos goes through the data that had the DEA so alarmed. Like MDMA seizures were up, U.S. Customs seizures of ecstasy were up from 381,000 tablets in all of 1997. And in the first 2 months of 2000 alone, you had 3.5 million tablets getting seized. ER visits from ecstasy, emergency room visits, are up 20% nationally. You had a 1999 Morristown, New Jersey event that ended with 80 arrests and 15 hospitalizations. You had a Miami party that had one death, 10 hospitalizations, and 30 drug arrests. you know, Chicago had clamped down especially hard. They'd already killed the original house scene in the 80s with regulation. Now they added a new city council bill that fined unlicensed or uninsured venues up to $10,000 and imposed a 2 a.m. curfew. And also there was a really nasty drug called PMA that was sometimes being substituted for ecstasy, and that is a much nastier drug. You know, and people like John Cornyn, who was the Texas Attorney General at the time, and is still a just legendary dumbass, but he said, quote, "Most party promoters meet the legal definition for criminal street gang." So, and then a San Bernardino County supervisor said, "Any rave is ipso facto promotes an outcome that's destined for disaster." So this is the context it's happening in. But let's hear our last song. This is Test Your Ashbowl Gravity. And that was Gravity by Tessier Ashpool. Is it Tessier, Tessier?
Tessier.
Tessier, Tessier Ashpool. Why did we pick this one?
I just thought it was a great track from that documentary. I really, you know, that one there was just, I was looking through and I was like, well, this one I just really like a lot. It's kind of got a lot of old school elements to it, but some new school vibes as well. So yeah, just personal pick on my part.
Yeah, excellent choice. That soundtrack is kicking. It is a great soundtrack. And also the soundtrack works in a little bit, just a taste of New Orleans bounce, which is a distinctive flavor of hip hop that evolved in New Orleans around this time. And I'm curious why Matos didn't mention bounce. And I wonder if there was just no connection between the bounce scenes and the rave scene at all, or if there was and he overlooked it. But I'm curious about that because I love these crossovers between what's going on in hip hop and the EDM scene. But now let's talk about the case against Disco Donnie and the Burnett family, the owners of the State Palace Theater. So the DEA had been investigating him since January, and this is fall of 2000 by this point. They had attended 8 Disco Donnie events, and they bought drugs on premises at every one of those events. They were looking at hitting Donnie and the Burnetts with charges that would result in 20-year sentences if they were found guilty. Plus, they were going to throw on the continuing criminal enterprise charges, which carried another 20 years to life on top of that. Plus, they were going to hit him with the crack house law, which was a 1986 law written in a panic after Boston Celtics number one draft pick Lynn Bias died of a cocaine overdose the night of the NBA draft. This was a law that made impose a $500,000 fine to any owner or manager of a property used in any way to manufacture, distribute, or for the use of controlled substances. So just a brutally powerful law. And Donnie was, quote, the test case for a wider crackdown. And that's why they were doing things like seizing the glow sticks and bottled water, because those were, quote, drug paraphernalia. And this is something... Yeah, go ahead.
This was kind of the first. The crack house laws were obviously designed to hit crack houses and had never been used against like a bar or a music venue or anything else like that. So the what they were trying to do when they were grabbing like glow sticks and bottled water and stuff like that is under the crack house law, anything that's considered drug paraphernalia can be used to prove the fact that it is indeed a fall under the crack house law. So anything like pacifiers or Vicks vapor rub or candy necklaces or anything else like that, even bottled water, which is insane, was considered to be evidence that you know, you were operating a quote-unquote crack house.
Yeah, and they still have this backwards view when they do law enforcement on raves and dance events. They frown on people trying to keep kids hydrated. Like, you know, when the promoters try to take these steps, like have drug testing stations so you can see if what you're taking is what you want to take, or they are trying to encourage hydration, the authorities look on that as aiding drug use and drug abuse, which is yeah, just infuriating and totally backwards. But so this is the context that Disco Donnie and the Burnettes find themselves in. They offered Donnie a plea deal for 1 year in prison if he flips. They offer the Burnettes a 2-year deal if they plead guilty. And Donnie's lawyer is even like, you know, telling him, hey, kid, take the plea. I had a client who flew a plane full of cocaine from Colombia in, and he had to take a plea. And Donnie's like, but I didn't fly in a plane full of cocaine, you know, like he keeps waiting for somebody to notice, hey, I'm not a drug dealer, I'm innocent here. So finally, the ACLU takes over. They send in Graham Boyd, one of their attorneys, makes it a freedom of speech issue.
I heard a really interesting story about how the ACLU got Donnie off or basically got Donnie out of the hot seat is that basically he told them, Donnie, to say that he would accept a plea deal with the DEA, which basically kind of took the DEA's sights off of him. And then about a year later, when it was time to sign the deal, he was like, I'm not signing that deal. And then he pleaded not guilty at the court. But basically the way that the DEA works is they're good cop or they're bad cop. And they'll be good cop to you if they think that you're participating in their organization and willing to give them whatever they want to go after whoever they feel is the bad guy of the moment. You just have to keep yourself from being that bad guy. So this is actually a pretty smart idea, is basically say you're taking the plea deal and then just wait and then say, I'm not signing anything, and then plead not guilty. And then they will have spent all this time not collecting evidence on you, and they'll kind of be stuck with a weaker case.
But be careful, because they will try to screw you hard if they can, if you do that. And Donnie kept trying to promote. On October 7th, 2000, he was booked to host a Moonshine of America tour stop at the State Palace. They couldn't do it at the State Palace, so he moves it out the country at a club called Pure Country. Carl Cox, the British DJ, is one of the DJs there. He was not impressed. There was a Confederate flag over the stage. He's like, no thanks, I'm going to stay in the bus. You know, he's a black guy from England. He doesn't want any part of the Deep South, and I do not blame him at all. That stuff is extremely scary. And there's cops and news crews everywhere. The cops are searching, the crews coming in. They still have the event, but it's clearly marred. On October 27th, he tries to hold his vampire stripper sluts from outer space party. Had to move that from a State Palace theater to a warehouse that was next to a Cajun restaurant. The police managed to contact the owner and scare them off, so the event's canceled. And that was it for Donnie trying to book big parties. He does find a gig working, putting club nights on at the House of Blues, which the House of Blues is a super corporate music venue in New Orleans. So he's able to get away with that. But yeah, like you said, by March 2001, the case is quietly dropped because there was no evidence. And there was a ton of embarrassing media mocking the DEA for you know, seizing glow sticks and stuff like that. The Burnettes pled guilty on the crack house law and paid a $100,000 fine, which was still cheaper than going to trial. And that's
apparently only paid $10,000 of that fine. They said they only had $10,000 in the bank account. They paid that, and that was the only money ever paid. They were told by the government, like, we don't care what you're pleading guilty to. You just have to plead guilty to something. So it was a complete face-saving operation.
Yeah, and I'm glad to hear that, because, I mean, the State Palace guys did nothing but rent out their venue for dance music. You know, so good thing that it put together. And then, you know, Tommy Sunshine, though, points out that I don't even think it took a month. The entire thing, and I think he means raves nationally, just crumbled. Everyone, no matter their role, DJ, sound man, ticket taker, you're looking at a $10,000 fine for being involved in a rave. So this immediately has this massive chilling effect all over the country. And, you know, one of the sentences that I flagged was, if you were involved in this culture, it was going to end up with you in federal prison. So that's a pretty ominous note to end the chapter on.
Yeah, and this the crack house laws being used against rave promoters, and then the Rave Act pushed by President, well, then just
Senator
Biden, like basically really put the spook on everybody. I mean, Kurt X, who was the guy who was doing all those Midwest Satan raves with even further and everything, even he was like, okay, this is no longer a good idea. And when you're scaring away the Satanists, then you've got really no one left, you know? So I can't overstate how much it freaked everybody out, because now you had a law that was the way it was written, you were guilty. And if they wanted to come down, it was kind of funny when you read the details on the Disco Donnie case, how it's like they had no idea kind of what was really going on. But and that's kind of good in a way, but it's bad in another way, because you could be just a bystander in the wrong place at the wrong time. And you could just be connected to somebody or something and have your life just ruined. So,
yeah, this was scary and bad times. And it kind of leads us into the next decade, which is kind of a decade in the wilderness. Is that a fair assessment for electronic dance music?
I mean, it was definitely like, I'd say like 2001 to 2005. Like, again, the underground never goes away, but you're going to lose all the people who are trying to build something, and everybody's kind of doing it fly by night now, and everybody's trying to do it anonymously. No one's trying, you know, it's hard to do these kinds of events if you're not trying to build up to something, and it leads to the worst tendencies of a scene kind of coming out. So it wasn't good for really anybody, the fact that we had such a heavy breathing government down our backs.
Yep. And so we'll continue the discussion next time when we talk about the Electroclash Festival of 2001. For Ryan Harkness, I'm Nate Wilcox, and we've been discussing Michelangelo Matos's The Underground is Massive, How Electronic Dance Music Conquered America.
Follow the Let It Roll podcast on Twitter at Let It Rollcast, and check out our website at letterrollpodcast.com. Next week, Ryan and Nate talk about the turn of the millennium, 9/11, mashups, Electroclash, and the era when Vice magazine laid down the laws of hipsterdom. Let It Roll is a Pantheon podcast, and you can listen to more great podcasts at www.pantheonpodcast.com.